This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rabkin. First Draft highlights the voices of writers as they discuss their work, their craft, and the literary arts. My guest who joined me via Skype is Paul Yoon, author of Once the Shore, The Snow Hunters, and The Mountain. He is a recipient of the 5 Under 35 Award from the National Book Foundation and is a Briggs Copeland Lecturer at Harvard University. His latest book, The Mountain, is a collection of 6 short stories that take place around the world, from Russia to South Korea, Shanghai to Spain, France to upstate New York. The characters that inhabit these stories experience loss, loneliness, displacement, and luminous moments. Told in spare, austere style, the tales of The Mountain investigate people physically and spiritually on the move. We began by discussing what was haunting Yoon as he wrote the collection.
It's sort of a two-pronged answer, but I think the major thing that I was thinking of was, and I'll preface this and say that this is not an original thought at all, but I was thinking about lately how much access we have to events throughout the world, in particular violent events, because of, say, social media like Twitter or something. We can kind of hear about, you know, a terrorist attack instantly, or even something smaller than that, something, you know, domestic or something more intimate within a household. So I was sort of thinking about this idea of like how much access we have and how easily we can access these things. And I want to sort of tackle that in some way in book form. And rather than sort of the obvious route, which would have been sort of, we're all connected, I thought it'd be more interesting to simply write a book that was set around the world, like sort of a global book. And stories seem to be a good way to do that, or an interesting way to do that. So that's basically how the book started, which is that I wanted to conceive of a book that was set in as many places as possible without having it be sort of, you know, messy or chaotic, or kind of felt like jumbled in some way.
I'm curious about your interest in violence, because it's something that I noted and I wrote down that in several of your stories, there's personal violence. It's usually one person was hitting someone attacked another character out of the blue, hit someone with a shovel. And I just wanted to ask you about that. And if you want to talk about it in context of each story, we can, or if you want to talk about it more generally.
You know, there are these sort of, you know, personally, there were these moments where I would wake up and, you know, turn on the news or listen about something, and I'm watching, you know, violent events unfold live on television. And I was watching this stuff, and again, whether it's, you know, whether it's a war or something else, whether it's gun violence in this country, I was sort of watching this, and I wasn't entirely sure how I was processing it, you know, and sort of I started thinking about how shocking that was to me, that I was able to sort of view this, and equally shocking that I wasn't really sure how to process the fact that I was viewing it and had this kind of intimate access to it. And it literally just got me thinking about just sort of how everyone else is processing all this, whether, you know, these are people my age or whether they're older or even children, right, who can sort of access all this stuff online and think about it, you know, and watch it on TV. So I think in that way, in a more sort of general way, I think violence was on my mind while I was writing these stories. And it just so happened that, like, there are these sort of moments in each story that sort of hinge on a moment of violence because of that.
Sometimes they seem to come out of nowhere. Other times I understand them. But for instance, in your second story in the book, which is called Still a Fire.
Still a Fire. Yeah, exactly.
There's this woman, and her name is Corrine, and she was a nurse, and she was helping out in a hospital, and she got addicted to morphine, and she left the hospital with a patient and ended up under the care of this man named Emil. And they are out, I think they're in a dump, looking for things, and all of a sudden he starts hitting her. She did ask him a question, but basically, you know, she said kind of, what was your life before this?
Right.
And I was shocked. He had been taking care of her.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could just talk about this moment where this caregiver kind of turns on this person.
Yeah, absolutely. And in some ways, that has nothing to do with her. It's sort of this repressed violence that's sort of within him. But it's sort of, you know, my hope was that in that moment, there's a boiling point that's been reached because of the long history of the Second World War in France and all that these characters have gone through. And in some ways, you know, Emil, Karine, Mikhail, all the characters in that story, they have yet to sort of process the years that they have survived and gone through. And they've reached this point where they've each reached this point in that story where they're confronted by a kind of crossroads where they can step one way or step the other way. And in that moment, I think when he sort of senses this woman who has been caring for him, I think he senses that she actually might have the power to leave him, you know, and is challenging him in some way. He sort of is presented in this crossroad where he can sort of accept that or do something else about it. And he ends up doing something else about it, but it's sort of translated into a kind of horrific way.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest who joined me via Skype is Paul Yoon, author of The Mountain.
I felt like a lot of your settings took place after tragedies. So they were a lot to me. They were the aftermath. They were after the war. They were after a missing parent. They were after a divorce. They were sort of in that, I wouldn't say they were totally like a liminal space, but they were like just off of precipices. Do you think that's fair?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's absolutely fair and accurate to say, which leads me to the second sort of part of your original question, which is, you know, the sort of seed of this book, which is that I was coming at this book from sort of a great place of transition. You know, my wife's a fiction writer as well, and so for many years we've been kind of like hopping around various locations because of day jobs, right? Looking for work, making money. You know, we would go somewhere, unpack our things and try to do our day jobs and try to write our books. And then we'd finish whatever job that was. And, you know, most of the times it was teaching and our contracts would be up and we'd pack up, right? And move somewhere else again. And it made me think of, like, that's sort of been my history. I grew up in a kind of peripatetic life where my dad, who's a retired doctor, he was sort of hopping around hospitals in the New York area. And so we moved often, and I was never at home. I never felt at home anywhere because we were moving around so much. And so I was thinking about all this, and when I was given the opportunity to write this book, I was coming at it from this place where I was constantly in motion, constantly moving, thinking about the places I've left, where we end up, why we leave, right, why we flee, and what we search for. Your thought about sort of aftermath and a kind of state of limbo, right, or a liminal space, is that I think the echo of that was that I was interested in sort of migratory patterns, and trauma or the aftermath of trauma became sort of the gateway or the door for these people to physically move somewhere, whether they're fleeing or looking for, you know, a new place to settle or a new family.
I felt like a lot of these characters were searching for something that was missing. It was a lost French mother or a Korean boy who disappeared, or a search for a husband. Do you think that search is innate to these other things you were looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just sort of interested in this idea of, do we ever feel whole, right? So, and if we don't ever feel complete or whole, then what is that sort of piece of us that's missing, right? And is it something that we're searching for? Are we aware that we're searching for it? So oftentimes they may physically be, you know, or literally be missing someone or something, but I think it also sort of speaks to something more, you know, like philosophical or psychic.
When you literally get down to writing these stories, when you had all these questions on your mind about violence and loneliness and migration, you know, then you write these stories that are, they're tangible, and they have characters and they have settings, and they are, you know, they take place in upstate New York and in China and in Scotland. And how do you end up taking, you know, these ideas and actually putting the pen to a paper to create a story? Do you start with an image? Do you start with a character?
I start as small as possible. And whether that's an image or a sentence, it has to be very, very small. It has to be a baby step and, you know, microscopic. I think if I entered fiction writing solely thinking about sort of a theme or an idea, which is, you know, obviously what we've been talking about right now, I think I would sort of crumble and fall apart at the kind of enormity of that. It would be too much pressure, right? So the trick to writing for me is actually you do have ideas, right? You do have thoughts when you want to conceive of some, you know, a book project or a story, but you have to sort of trick yourself into not thinking about it when you start writing and to just simply start very, very small. And so, for example, the first story, A Willow and the Moon, was the first story I wrote for this book. And the only thing I was sure of in that book was that there was a building in a mountain. That was it. So that's how I conceived of the first sentence, which is, it was once a sanatorium in the mountains. And that was all I knew. Had no idea it was going to be set in, you know, the first half of the 20th century until well into the story. No idea who the characters were, no idea, you know, like whether, you know, who the family members were or anything like that.
And this story is told from first person about a young boy whose mom worked at the sanitarium up in upstate New York. And he would go with her. It was after the war. She would take care of people who injured people, maybe physically, mentally injured. And his father kind of disappeared. And we follow this character as he remembers his mother and moves on to other places and comes back. So he has the loss of his mother, who gets addicted to morphine, and then the father who disappears.
You know, In this sort of way that completely surprised me and I wasn't aware of, it became the map of the book, where it's the story that sort of, it's the epicenter, right? So, and then from there, like, the book branches out. So for me, whether they be themes or images that recur throughout the book, right? The sort of, you know, the motifs, and the idea of migration and travel and loss, it's all sort of in that story for me. So that became a kind of lovely surprise and also a great comfort, because I'd sort of, you know, when you're sort of lost in a book project, you need those anchors. So it was a story I often returned to and sort of relied on.
Yeah, I could see that it could set the stage. So in this, the main character goes back later to the sanatorium to just explore where he spent time with his mom and to mourn. And then he meets a stranger there. And we find a lot of the people in these stories meet strangers, and it might be a short meeting. Like, you had a woman who went on a train trip with a man she met at her hotel, or a woman who was working in China who met up with the man who got her to China from Korea, or the and that sort of thing. So I felt like meeting with strangers was something that repeated a lot. And I guess that is inevitable in the migrant life, that you're going to meet strangers, but I'm wondering if you can comment on that.
Yeah, I think this also comes from personal experience. You know, whether I'm traveling, I was fortunate enough to be able to travel a lot when I was younger, or even sort of on a day-to-day level, I find moments with strangers to be quite magical. You know, whether that's just saying hi to someone as I'm running because, you know, we happen to run at the same time, right? So we wave to each other, or doing the classic backpacking across Europe when you're a teenager in the 90s and, you know, staying at a hostel and staying up all night with someone, talking, knowing that you'll never see that person again. Those sort of moments have always stayed with me, and they continue to stay with me. So I think for me, the idea of that kind of short and yet lasting connections with people throughout the world, you know, who go about living their own lives and kind of branch out and splinter out everywhere geographically, that's a beautiful thing to me. So I think about that often. And so I think that kind of came, that sort of translated into the book as well. But it also sort of ties in with loneliness, right? I think for these characters, they are lonely, but I think they're also, they feel slightly kind of disconnected, like they're unable to sort of connect with anyone. And so they latch on to these sort of surprise moments with strangers, these passing moments.
Yeah, and it can be so easy to sort of love a stranger because nothing gets complicated with strangers.
Exactly. Again, to go back to your saying about sort of the aftermath of trauma, right? I think there are a lot of events, whether they're intimate or world events, that these characters sort of have not processed. And so oftentimes when they're like faced with this opportunity to process it, it leads to kind of horrific violence because, you know, they don't know what else to do. But it's also, I think, in line with this sort of idea where here's someone that I can kind of latch onto for a moment and sort of feel safe with. Not to talk about Willow for too long, but all of that was there in that first story. I'm fully aware of like the crazy sort of white space and air of that story, right? I sort of let a lot of things linger in the space breaks and the white, the pages where, you know, years pass and I don't explain what happened. And I knew it was kind of a kooky, crazy thing to construct a story where I'm doing this stuff, where I'm letting so many things not reveal themselves. And yet I just sort of had a feeling that it was an okay thing to do for this project. And so it gave me the courage to continue to do that as the book progressed, where what's not said and the white space.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest who joined me via Skype is Paul Yoon, author of The Mountain.
One of the things I notice with a lot of these, it was rare in the stories. I mean, it wasn't exclusive, but it was rare that we learned the narrator's name. In a way, this is like they're a stranger to us as the reader. But I'm wondering about the choice to not name these people, if it was a choice or if it was just how it happened.
I think it was how it happened. It wasn't something that I was sort of thinking about for the first person stories. The first story and the last story in Mulner Field, the narrators aren't named. It wasn't something I was aware of. I wrote these stories, and I realized only until I had finished, a full draft that I was satisfied with, that I had never named them. And I let it be. I let it be because I sort of liked the idea. You know, you're sort of towing this line between, you know, wanting kind of clarity and an anchor, and reaching too far into sort of abstraction, right? So I knew I was kind of towing this line where I didn't want it to be a frustrating experience for the reader, right? But I did sort of like this idea that if I didn't name the narrator, how would that experience change to the reader? And how would that experience add or complement this world I was trying to build, where you have so many sort of voices all throughout the world, you know, singing all at once, so to speak? And that was an interesting idea for me.
And what do you think you gain or lose with an actual name?
Well, for this particular book, I think if I had named the characters, I wondered if it was going to put them in a very, very specific room in sort of like the house building. And for me, I almost wondered if it would be better if I let that voice sort of be able to move around different rooms in the house, so to speak, in an almost kind of fluid way, or almost like ghost-like way. And that was something that was intriguing to me. In terms of loss, I think, you know, you're in danger of letting those voices float away, right? And, you know, escape out the window. And so, you know, whether I succeeded or not, that's up to the readers. But my hope is I was able to sort of stay in the house that I had built, but have that fluidity as well.
The other thing that I found in your story is what you literally had a lot of empty houses on mountains.
Yeah.
Did you ever explore an empty house as a kid, or what was the either metaphor or real thing?
I actually have no idea. Yeah, I mean, of course I explored empty houses as a kid. For a few years we lived in a town in upstate New York, and we lived on this hill, and we were on a slope of a hill, and at the crest, you know, at the peak, there was always this house that was like, I felt like it was forever being constructed, and it was empty. And it was like a sort of, exposed frame and all that. So, yeah, I mean, I explored it often. I don't know how much, who's to say, I can't say how much I was thinking of that memory when I was writing this book. It's funny how sometimes, things sort of pop up in fiction that you're aware of, and other things pop up that you're just not aware of at all, right? That isn't intentional. I think empty spaces and abandoned spaces lend itself well to this book, simply in terms of like thinking about, migration and sort of leaving and abandoning something, but also, again, like this sort of the idea of destruction and physical destruction, whether that's sort of in the aftermath of a war where you have sort of a ravaged country, or simply just like the aftermath of a personal life and a sort of like a life that one is sort of fleeing, right? And so the pieces of wreckage there were interesting to me, but more interesting to me was actually someone finding the evidence of a wreckage that wasn't theirs, right? So Kareen in Spill of Fire ends up in an abandoned, kind of ruined cottage in the Pyrenees at the end of that story. It's not her wreckage, right? It's not something that she did. It's someone else's. And so that was interesting for someone to occupy someone else's abandoned space.
And she ended up also kind of with a stranger there, similar to the first one, who was a child.
Yeah, absolutely. And this, in kind of thinking about, how do we start anew? How do we start again? So they occupy this place that's ruined, but they'll build it again, right? And make it their own. And, chances are, in sort of the vision of this book, it's not the last place they'll end up, right? They'll probably move again, or she'll move again. There's the hope of staying and settling, but most likely that won't happen. So, these kind of layers and patterns and threads of what we leave behind, what we abandon, and then who do we find? What do we find, right?
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest who joined me via Skype is Paul Yoon, author of The Mountain.
Can you read something from an author that speaks to you or influenced you as a writer?
I'm going to read to you from an early novel by Michael Ondaatje called In the Skin of a Lion. That's essentially the predecessor to The English Patient, where some of the characters from The English Patient first appear. And I'm actually just going to read the first two paragraphs of In the Skin of a Lion. If he is awake early enough, the boy sees the men walk past the farmhouse down First Lake Road. Then he stands at the bedroom window and watches. He can see two or three lanterns between the soft maple and the walnut tree. He hears their boots on gravel, dirty loggers wrapped up dark, carrying axes and small packages of food, which hang from their belts. The boy walks downstairs and moves to a window in the kitchen where he can look down the driveway. They move from right to left. Already they seem exhausted before the energy of the sun. Sometimes he knows this collection of strangers will meet the cows being brought in from a pasture barn for milking, and there will be a hushed politeness as they stand at the side of the road, holding up the lanterns. One step back and they will be in a knee-high snowdrift, to let the cows lazily pass them on the narrow road. Sometimes the men put their hands on the warm flanks of these animals and receive their heat as they pass. They put their thin gloved hands on these black and white creatures who are barely discernible in the last of the night's darkness. They must do this gently, without any sense of attack or right. They do not own this land as the owner of the cows does.
Tell me about choosing this. What moved you?
So much. The first thing that I love about this is I love the way this excerpt has so many layers to it. If you reread it, you'll notice the way the boy sees things is separated into different categories, where he wakes up first, and then he moves to the bedroom window, and then he inches downstairs. So there are these steps to his sort of view of what's going on. I love the way that sets up a book that essentially has multiple layers in it, and how each sort of point of view that the boy experiences reveal something different about the loggers and the cows. So there's that. I love the way it's moving, right, within the house. Bernadette is so great at this, these sort of moments of surprise for me, where you're witnessing a scene, and then there's this gesture of surprise. Something happens that surprises me, and when the men sort of step back and let the cows pass, there's this moment when they put their hands on the warm flanks of the animal and receive their heat. And to me, that was such a surprise. I wasn't expecting that gesture. I would have thought that they would have just kind of stepped back and kind of and let the animals pass and not touch them, but they do. And there's this kind of moment of sort of magic there for me, and connection. So I love that. And of course I love, at the end, these people, they do not own this land, right, as the owner of the cows does. So these people, the loggers, they are not of this place, right? They're passersby, and it is not their home. So there's this sort of that's obviously something that speaks to me as well.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed from the first draft, or something that you just like.
The whole book was hard, so I don't think we have time for me to read the entire book. But what I will do is I will actually just read the opening of Willow and the Moon. There was once a sanatorium high up in the mountains. My mother worked there. In the summers, I worked with her early and took the wooded trail near our home. She brought us breakfast, usually some bread with cold jam and butter. And halfway up the slope, we found a spot with a view and rested. In the valley, there was a town and a distant river. On some days, we could see the train come up in the city, blowing smoke into the sky. South of this was our house and the horse farm my father was employed by. Sometimes I could even see my father across a paddock. I recognized this strange gait from when a horse kicked his hip before I was born. He came from a family of farriers. The house was one we rented from a wealthy Dutchman whom I never saw. It had four rooms on one floor. Our most valuable possession was a piano my mother owned. She used to play before the First War. She had come to America to perform in a concert hall in Manhattan. Her name was Josephine. She was from France.
Tell me about that.
It was literally the first two paragraphs that I wrote for this book. And I think about it often because I had absolutely no idea where I was going with this. And so it felt both dangerous and uncertain. And I was writing it in a time sort of great. You know, I just felt sort of uncertain about everything in terms of this book. I was going very slowly and carefully. And I think it lent itself to us an interesting voice where there is a kind of slowness to it that's sort of reflective of that. It's also, it was tricky for me because it was first person, which I don't often write in. And so I felt kind of vulnerable writing in the first person. I knew it wasn't me. You know, obviously it wasn't me. Yet I'm typing I. So part of it felt like it was me. And so I felt a bit more exposed writing this, I should say, than sort of stories that are in the third person. And, you know, why that is, I'm not entirely sure. But there was definitely that. There was a kind of fragility to it, too. And then, as you sort of warm up to it and the voice, the armor kind of comes back on and you feel more confident. And then, of course, you finish it and get stripped away. And writing is a total roller coaster in that way.
Where do you write?
Good question. Well, I wrote this book in an office at the New York Public Library, which was the first time I ever had an office. My wife and I had moved around so much that I have no consistent place to write. I sometimes write on the dining table. I sometimes write on a couch and sometimes in an office. So it's never consistent. I'm kind of constantly moving around, which used to infuriate me. And now I find it interesting in that your point of view is always slightly altered when you're writing. And so it lends itself to sort of interesting things on the page, I think.
And what do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I run every morning. It's sort of that one thing I need. Running is interesting to me. It feels at once like you're running away from something, but also coming back to whatever it is. I need that morning run if I'm wrestling with something, you know, whether it's a short story or a novel I'm working on. I take off running, and there's that moment where I need to shed that frustration. And then you get to that point where you have a blank slate again, and you kind of start wrestling with whatever it is that's been troubling you, you know, whether it's a particular scene or you know, a structural level or something like that, or a character. And within, you know, that moment when I'm running. Not always able to figure it out, but I can sort of figure out sort of steps to making it better. And then I come back home and sort of with renewed energy and strength. So that's my ritual.
And who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
I show my work to three people. My wife, who always reads early drafts of my work. My agent, who I usually show my work to around the same time as my wife. They're definitely first readers of mine. And a dear friend of mine, the fiction writer Ethan Rutherford, who has been a reader of mine for, oh God, I don't know, over 15 years. So he's been, you know, having to read my, you know, crappy drafts for a long time. So.
And how have you dealt with rejection?
In terms of when I was first starting off and sending out stories to magazines, I would get those, you know, those form rejection letters. And a great way for me to deal with it was I kept all the form letters, all the stuff in a file folder, and the pile would just start, you know, piling up, and they would get like thicker and thicker. And then I would move on. I had a hard time selling my first book, Once the Shore. So like I had piles and piles of, you know, rejection letters from publishers too. So, you know, I don't know if it's masochistic, but it actually helped me deeply to sort of have that pile. It didn't depress me. It didn't discourage me at all. It just simply made me want to keep going. So those physical artifacts of the rejection letters were actually quite necessary for me to keep going.
And what is your favorite word?
My favorite word is whatever word that works in the sentence that I'm working on. So I guess if I'm working on a sentence, Like yesterday night I was writing and I wrote a sentence I was really pleased with. Whatever word that made me very pleased with that sentence is my favorite word, so it's ever changing.
You've been listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. My guest who joined me via Skype was Paul Yoon, author of Once the Shore, The Snow Hunters, and The Mountain. You can follow First Draft on Facebook. Just look for First Draft, a dialogue on writing, and click like, and on Twitter at First Draft APR. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. Thanks for listening.